Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday morning. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And once again, he will join us this morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hey there. I'm happy to be joining the suitably skeptical Marshall Miles from the media capital of the world once again, New York City.
Skeptic, you know, it's funny. I've been out for about a week because I've had some stem cell replacement in my knees, and you know, I don't really miss.
What have you missed?
I don't really miss what I missed. Okay. if that's not grammatically correct, but it's a true statement. But anyway, let's get over to the real thing. The Olympics. I have to say this. This is just a shambles this year, David. It's a little embarrassing.
What's the shambles?
The way that the coverage is going of the Olympics and
the Olympics. Yeah, as we speak, in fact, live Friday morning at least, Tokyo is going through, if that's the right phrase for it, the ceremony for opening the Olympics, and yes, shambolic, chaotic, troublesome, it's all of those adjectives, I think, and yet, in spite of the considerable risks involved, in spite of the fact that the polling that shows that the Japanese public are dead set against the Olympics happening in their country at a time of COVID, and of course, inevitably spiking cases, and despite all the precautions being taken in the Olympic Village and all the other elements of the Olympics operation, cases being reported amongst athletes and support staff, and in spite of all this, they're going ahead. And so many chances that there have been in the last few months for it to be cancelled as more and more negative evidence was mounting against the wisdom of holding the Olympics. None of those chances were taken, and I guess because of the all-powerful mammon involved, the finance involved in the Olympics, as always, money talks louder than anything else in the equation, and here we are with the Olympics about to start with very few spectators, a smattering of journalists. And altogether, a picture that can't be very inspiring, even for the most dedicated athletes whose work and whose dedication is extraordinarily praiseworthy. But it seems to be not exactly going to waste, but it seems a shame for it to be put to the test in such dismal circumstances.
And just one final note on the Olympics. I found out when I started looking at news on Thursday was there was a bear that was loose in the softball stadium, and they were playing games because they hadn't found the bear yet.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's almost emblematic of the craziness of the situation, I think. Political scandals going on in Japan too, which form an extraordinary backdrop to this. The Abe presidency there, the prime ministership there, is rocked once more by the sort of stories that politicians never like to see, and yet again, a backdrop of discouragement, and of course, at bottom, fundamentally speaking, it's a massive gamble with people's lives, and that's hard to condone. It really is.
And we'll head into the amazing pandemic story in a moment with this story. An Australian activewear firm called Lorna Jane has been fined £2.6 million. Those are Australian dollars, for claiming its clothing eliminated and stopped the spread of COVID. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, we're very used to hyperbole and you know, magical claims, especially during a pandemic. The snake oil salesman is a long tradition, of course, in the Western world and probably all over the world. But I'm thinking of, you know, trying of you know, explorative times like the press westward in the United States, where snake oil salesmen had a field day, and of course, at times when we were all concerned about our health, phony remedies are legion, and it's this was a, I have to admit, this is a pretty spectacular one. You know, buy an outfit that can protect you. That's a pretty good selling line, but clearly not good enough.
All right, so let's go into the weirder aspects of COVID. Now everybody knows that the lab in China was funded by U.S. and other countries, by the way. But now this you really don't know, because where it's coming from. You've got Facebook, you've got Twitter, you've got all these different networks, and these stories about COVID, this is just an amazing thing. I think if people back in time, when there were pandemics in this country and people responded differently, they would look at this, and if you made this in a movie and brought it back about 40 years, nobody would believe it.
Well, the rumor mill is something else, as well as the snake oil mill, if I can describe it as that. The rumor mill always gets stoked by epidemics, and the pandemic is global, and this time, of course, the rumor mill is global, and splits off in so many different directions. It's no surprise. It's yet another reminder that the media consumers like ourselves and our audiences just need to be extra careful about everything they read. The skepticism that I was highlighting in your makeup, which I'm very glad to encounter every week, is a vital part of us being media consumers. We must always be asking ourselves as we read or hear or watch pieces of information that strike us as extraordinary. Just how credible is this? You know, the fundamental skepticism, if you like, has to be maintained, even more during a pandemic than any other time. We must rely on what we know from our own experience have been established as reliable sources, and always ask the question when we see something that strikes us as extraordinary, ask the fundamental questions. You know, how do they know this? Where do they get that information from? Who is the they, anyway? Consider the source. Always consider the source. Is it one that I already know? Do I trust it? If I don't trust it, is there any other source which is independently saying anything by the way of corroboration, or is this an outlier of a story? All those things need to be raised as important questions when we consider some of the wacky stories that get told around the world, and of course shared unthinkingly by far too many people who just press the retweet button or share indiscriminately because something strikes them as odd or wild or funny. Even in some cases, people just quite irresponsibly, just for a gag, for a laugh sometimes, will pass things on that they probably know in deep down themselves it's just not true, but they just want to stir the pot, I guess. And that kind of mischievousness becomes more than mischief, becomes downright harmful when amplified, especially through our modern miracle, I will unwillingly call it, of social media.
All right, now we've got our sound effect all set. Are you ready?
Sure, I'm ready to celebrate a good bit of excellent journalism. Let's hear it. Well, it's what's being called a doozy of a the digital espionage case. It's the Pegasus story. This is the spyware, the company called NSO from Israel, who developed this extraordinarily powerful cybersecurity spying app. It's more than an app. It's a whole network, it involves extraordinarily expansive computer power spread across many nations. The company is an Israeli firm, which is pretty typical of the Israeli electronics industry. Many of its members, it's an extraordinarily competitive industry, the Israeli electronics industry and digital electronics in particular. And I have a lot of experience myself. My own website was mounted by a crack team of Israeli cyber experts, and a lot of their own experience. These very expert individuals often gained their first experience of cyber activity and expertise in the Israeli Defense Force, and there's a close association between that industry and the national security establishment of Israel. So it's always been known that the spyware that is operated by NSO is very, very efficient. But what we've seen from the extraordinary piece of journalistic collaboration across many countries that is been published this week in something like 17 different long established journalistic organizations, news organizations across several continents, all collaborating together to check on the overall story that has been coordinated from Paris by a non-profit journalistic organization called Forbidden Stories. It was formed in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo magazine shootings and killings, and it works to essentially protect the interests of journalists at risk. And guess what? They discovered that amongst the many people that were under surveillance, there's a list that was created, or at least it was leaked to Forbidden Stories in association with the human rights organization, which is worldwide, the Amnesty International, that they worked with. And they got their hands on this extraordinary list of 50,000 phone numbers for politicians, judges, lawyers, journalists, of course, teachers, and many others. And it's an extraordinary list. On that list are 10 prime ministers, including and 3 presidents, including the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, and a king. It's quite an extraordinary hit list, not every single one of those phone numbers can be checked, of course, but a sizable, at least a significant sample of the numbers have been checked. The researchers and reporters across this massive team effort managed to check physically on 37 phones, and they were mostly iPhones. It's important to point out, Apple often claims that its products are a lot safer and more secure than, say, Android devices. But in fact, we're not sure if this is a revealing fact or not, but it happens to be a fact that most of the phones that they were able to make checks, physical checks on, happen to be iPhones. And they're very vulnerable to this particularly high-powered piece of spyware. The intrusion on a target's phone can do all the things that we're also concerned, might happen to our phone, that they will commandeer, the spyware will commandeer our contacts, our search activity, our photographs, our every communication, whether by calls or by texts or by emails, And it's all it turns us all into something of an open book. And more than that, it can even, as we're all too well aware from previous cases like this, it can activate our phone as a listening device and just eavesdrop on our everyday activities. Of course, it's an alarming set of revelations. And other journalists too. The established organizations that have been part of it are in this country, the Washington Post, and in Britain, the Guardian. But every other journalist in this field has been activated by it, of course. And we see the New York Times, for instance, which is not part of the original combination, has been on the same story too. And that in itself is quite useful, the fact that journalists outside of this particular network that was concentrating on this one story are now independently corroborating that. And the New York Times, for instance, had discovered that been independently able to corroborate the targeting of phones amongst government people in Mexico and in other countries too, and established the fact that not only is there another kind of independent cadre of journalists able to corroborate this, but they've actually followed up and discovered that in the case of some countries, the number of targets being addressed by the NSO spyware is even greater in number than already reported.
Amazing. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't come back to this country and the embarrassment that is our government, which is the Senate and the House. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She's never been a real favorite of mine. She's a strong leader, and I give her credit for that. I've never agreed with her on a lot of things, but she took the stand to take two Republicans, which is her right, off the list that were recommended by the Republican leaders, simply because they came out very early on and just poo-pooed the idea of January 6th, and she said they didn't belong there. And then, of course, the Republican leader, the minority leader, says he's going to pull everybody out. You've got a bipartisan committee that's working well together on a package, and then you have once again the Republican leaders in the Senate saying they wouldn't even bring it to a procedural vote. I mean.
Yes, Capitol Hill is not distinguishing itself with any sense of joint purpose. I mean, bipartisanship, as we're virtually saying every week when we talk, seems to be a dead letter at the Capitol in both chambers. And in this particular case, the whole point of the exercise is to have a bipartisan committee of inquiry, essentially, centered in the House. This is in place of having an independent commission of inquiry, which founded as a proposal some time ago in the face of this extreme partisan and rigid partisanship that prevented any kind of real collaboration across the aisle. And the whole idea is to investigate what happened on January 6th at Capitol Hill, the riot. And unsurprisingly, I suppose, after Nancy Pelosi had picked herself, one individual member of Congress from the Republican side, a choice that she was perfectly happy to have, because Ms. Cheney, the Congresswoman, was already well on record as being horrified by the invasion, by the riot. That was a welcome Republican appointee, so welcome that the Democratic leader of the Speaker of the House made the appointment herself. But then when the Republicans made their suggestions, she exercised her right that was written into the proposal for the committee in the first place, that she could refuse any of the suggested appointments made by Kevin McCarthy, her opposite member on the Republican side, and the two individuals that she took exception to, the grounds for her exception, her distaste for them was the fact that they were on record themselves as this is how she sees it, at least, that they contributed to the build-up of that riot in the first place. And you know, you can see what she means. The evidence is clear that they were stirring the pot themselves as January approached. All the questions about the so-called unreliability of the vote. These were classic sort of stop the steal, that was the phrase at the time, if you remember, campaign by pro-Trumpists trying to claim against all the evidence that the election was being stolen from Trump. You can see why the Speaker of the House would be unhappy about people like that sitting on the committee, that inevitably these two individuals would prove to be spoilers and wreckers in the work of the investigative work of the committee, that they would start from a position of being in support, or at least having stoked the fire of that riot in the first place. Now whether that's a sensible political thing to do and ban the two people you don't want, and then the result of that is that all the Republicans, apart from the one already selected by the Democrats, are off the committee and will not be working alongside the Democratic counterparts and instead will be holding their own separate inquiry, is, you know, the saddest, to use an old Trump phrase, is really sad, as a reflection on the effectiveness of our elective representative bodies in getting to grips with anything in a serious manner. This does not look serious anymore.
All right, and just one final wrap-up. Around the globe, in Germany, in China, in the United States, you can no longer deny the effects that the climate is having, the change. It's just too drastic. It's just too widespread.
This is the climate change that we've been predicting for so long. It's happening before our very eyes now. No doubt about that. The horrific scenes from Europe, from China, and of course in the west of our own country. It's here. And so, what are we going to do about it? The next international combination of countries will be in my old home country of Scotland, in Glasgow, the city to the west of central Scotland. And in the fall, there will be some efforts there to get the Paris Climate Agreement to start to have better, stronger teeth. And we can only hope that these experiences of this summer will reinforce international opinion and a desire to get to grips with it finally.
Well, we're living through an amazing time, a historic time that hopefully years from now people will look back and will have that'll learn the lesson that if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. But you're here every week to help us sort out the fact from the fiction.
Well, I hope I can do my bit to help.
All right, David, we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, once again, you can find David on his own website, themediabeat.us. And a reminder, he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And you can also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.